Welcome to Talking Queer, the podcast series of the Gala Queer Archive, an LGBTQI archive based in Johannesburg, South Africa. I am Caio Araújo, a postdoctoral fellow at the WITS Institute for Social and Economic Research of WITS University. In this series, we'll talk about sexuality, gender, activism, and all things queer. In 8 episodes, we will engage writers, scholars, artists, and activists working in various locations. We want to create a conversation around issues of queer histories, memories and archives, arts and representation, and LGBTQI activism in the Global South. The podcast series is sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation with funds from the Federal Ministry of Economic Cooperation and Development of the Federal Republic of Germany. In today's episode, I have the great pleasure of chatting to Chike Frank-Eudosian. Frank is the director of New York University in Accra, and he directed the Institute's Ghana-based Reporting Africa program from 2008 to 2019. He is also a journalist who has been writing about government, health, and cultural issues for a variety of publications. He's also the author of the book Lives of Great Men from 2017, which received a Lambda Literary Award. The book, about which we'll speak today, is an exploration of the lives of contemporary queer men and women in the African continent and in the diaspora. So, Frankie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited for our chat. Let's start by talking about the book. It is really such a fascinating narrative, but we'll get to that in a moment. To start, I'm curious to hear more about the process of making the book. Why did you decide to write the book at the time that you did? And I'm also very curious to know, why did you decide to write a memoir and not, say, a journalistic piece or other forms of nonfiction? Can you walk us through these choices?
Sure. Initially, what I'd wanted to do was to just collect stories about people who were like me. That means there was a very finite period I was looking at, which was contemporary Africans in today's world. And the reason I started the reporting and the research for this was very simple. There was in the early 2010s, 2010, 2011 maybe, there was this situation. I was living in Ghana for the summer, and every day there was something about LGBTQ people on the front page of the newspapers. And it was always very pejorative. And as a journalist, I noticed that it was always very one-sided. And I was just baffled as to why that particular summer, there were all of these rash of anti-LGBTQ stories. Obviously, you just can't put these things in a vacuum. So I had to look at, see what else was happening around us that flared this up. This was happening at the same time that there had been all these repercussions from, it was called at the time, the Kill the Gays Bill out of Uganda. And so what we saw, or at least what I noticed in these countries, you know, Nigeria included, where I spend a lot of time and where I'm from, was this sort of heavy backlash being pushed by a certain segment of society. But what bothered me, what really sort of triggered me saying, you know, I have to do more than just a journalistic piece of work, was the former Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, signed the most draconian anti-LGBTQ bill on the eve of his election, which he lost, you know. But gay people have for some time now been the constituency that it's okay for everybody to hate. But the fact is that these bills had been every so often in the Nigerian parliament, and other presidents had understood that you could not criminalize people for their existence and had left it alone. But Goodluck Jonathan was facing a re-election. I believe he could see the signs that he was going to lose. And one of the things that he did was that he signed the most draconian bill that we've seen on our continent. And of course, there was worldwide attention to it. All of the CNNs and the newspapers, the global, you know, media wrote about this. But one of the things that struck me as a journalist was the paucity of voices of the people that this actually affected in these stories. Yes, of course, there were one or two activists, but the actual ordinary folk, the day-to-day people who are LGBTQ or just questioning their sexuality, you know, that were now at risk of being turned into criminals for existing. Those voices were absent. And I remember there was a tactic which I saw in India. when India was fighting for its own rights of everybody to be free. The LGBTQ community was always over there ridiculed as sort of like this minuscule minority, too small to make a difference. And I could see that happening here in Nigeria, but I recognize that that really was not the case. But this was what was going on in mainstream media. So I thought, if these people can't find anyone to talk to, and if this was going to be the record on our lives in this time, I needed to do a deeper dive, more long form work on these lives. And so initially, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to do a documentary. So I started up actually recording people telling me stories and then recording my, you know, people in my own family and in my own walls, like what do they remember about me growing up and all of that stuff. And as the project came together, it was clear to me that the best I could do was to do a print project, do a book. And as I got my first draft together, I remember my literary agent saying to me, this is interesting, but perhaps you want to talk a little bit more about yourself and switch the focus from this sort of nonfiction, deep dive look at all of these lives in today's world into your own journey and your own memories and your own memoir. And then I had a good friend of mine who at the time I was asking advice on you know, how to get books published and all of that. And he said to me, you have to kill the journalist in you for this project. Kill the journalist in you and just write your story with your own perspective. And then let's see what happens. That was the genesis and how Lives of Great Men came about. It is a memoir, but it's obviously heavily reported because I talk to so many people and I try to use my life, not just as an example, but the lives of all of these men and women that gave me the privilege of telling me their story and being frank about it. And I think that no one can say going forward that we don't exist in these countries or that they can't find us to talk to, because it's just, you know, the evidence doesn't support that.
Certainly. Let's talk about the narrative now. Something that struck me as a reader is the book's focus on love, right? You spent quite a lot of time writing about the difficulties and the challenges and the promises of finding love as a gay man in Nigeria, in Ghana, and in other places. And I was wondering, why was this focus on love so important to you?
Because I think love is at the center of everyone's life. But when it comes to LGBTQ people, very often we're viewed through a prism of sex and not the complete picture of our lives. So if I was going to have any success in really trying to show what our lives are like, I had to do it in a way that was complete. And a lot of our life and our actions, many of the choices we make are often emotional and are often seeking love and seeking connection. And, you know, while the sexual part may be titillating and it's what people grab onto, it's a very small part of our life, even though it plays a big role. I find that a lot of our lives and a lot of the things we do are reactions to love. And it's not always love of a couple. You know, LGBTQ people around the world, not just in Africa, are experts on chosen family. You know, when they cannot get that kind of love and support and affection from their blood families, there are other people who are ready to give it to them. And that, I find, it's a form of love. You know, we don't say it out loud, but it turns out that that is how we live. But the people that deride us seem to be obsessed with our sex lives. But our sex lives are just our sex lives. They're not our whole lives. It's something that we do, but it's not who we are. And so, you know, I didn't consciously set out to write about love, but I wanted a complete picture. And in examining my life and the life of all the LGBTQ people I know, love is always at the center. So that just sort of sprang up organically. It's like, aha, of course.
Sure, makes sense. And related to this question of love, another topic that, you know, runs throughout the book is the issue of marriage. You write quite a bit about the centrality of marriage in Nigerian society, in Ghanaian society. And you also write about how, because of the centrality, a lot of queer people end up also getting into heterosexual marriages. This will, of course, sound very familiar to a lot of people. What I find interesting in the book, though, is how you walk us through your change of mind, so to speak. You mentioned that when you were young, you tended to be quite judgmental of queer people getting married, and then as you grew older, you, as you say, got off your high horse, quote unquote. I find this change of heart quite interesting. How did that happen?
I think when you're younger, you tend to look at life through maybe your lived experience and the things that affect you directly. And as you get older, maybe you make space for a broader perspective. So people can be revolutionary and want change and want certain things, and at the same time be understanding of when that thing doesn't come. You know, when I was building a career, or at least trying to build a career, I was living in New York and I was working in media. And if I met another LGBTQ African who was doing the same thing as me, but were deep in the closet, I maybe looked down on them a little bit. Because for me, you're not at home anymore. There's someone looking over your shoulder. You're in a place where practically nobody knows you. You're a stranger here. You can be as free as you want. Why do you still have to do this? So that was sort of like the way I looked at it when I was in my 20s. And at the time, I was just like, well, you know, I'm not in the closet in New York. I'm not going to come and be in the closet anywhere else. Now, I made allowances for my friends in Nigeria because, as one of them very succinctly told me, you know, it's like, we're in the same career, but I cannot get that promotion that you've just had. Because I'm not married, I'm not going to be considered responsible if I don't have a wife. So this is something I must do. And I had seen many people do that for career choices. And then I had now seen the pressure that families put on their children to marry and procreate. So when you bring in somebody who's trying to have a solid middle-class career, being denied promotions, and then you bring the pressure of parents and family, wanting grandchildren, I could understand why certain people would succumb. I couldn't understand people in the diaspora doing that. I was very dismissive of people who were in the diaspora, who had made a career for themselves and returned home and conformed, because there was also that. And then I was like, you have this great job, you've gone home to Lagos and you also have this great job, or you've gone home to Accra, you've had this great job. But when you come back after years of being open and out, you just fall into what society here says is the right thing for you, which is get married, have children. Of course, as I got older, I just had a little bit more compassion because I just felt like I have to see the broader picture and I cannot be so judgmental of people who make the choices they have to make to survive. If you're going to live in our society and you're going to try and make a difference for yourself, it is really, really hard to be unmarried, not divorced, just unmarried, and say that your partner in life is a person of the same gender. On our continent, it's not easy. I mean, there are places where it doesn't matter. Obviously, it's a huge continent. But in a lot of these countries, it's really difficult. And so I had to sort of shift my thinking into saying, how can you be supportive of people like that and just have a little bit of compassion? And so, you know, I'm less judgmental of that. And I think I'm a bit more understanding as I've grown older, wishing that that were not the case. And knowing that whenever there's somebody who's out and proud and living a life that is admirable, it spurs other people to change their ways, even if it's done in a very quiet way. Not every breakthrough happens with holding a placard and storming parliament or having a big fight. Some breakthroughs happen because people can see people living good, authentic lives. So that's what pulled me off of my high horse.
Fascinating. Well, let's talk about women now. Obviously, that's not the main focus of the book. As the title suggests, this is a book about gay men mostly. Yet, here and there in the narrative, you do speak about a few women. And that made me wonder if you would have anything else to say about the different experiences of men and women in these queer spaces you're writing about.
Well, I didn't write so much about women, lesbian women, because I know so few. And once the focus of the narrative changed to being a memoir, I had to write about people who were in my life. So the few LGBTQ women that I knew were the ones whose perspective I wrote about. And I always felt like Lives of Great Men was sort of like this first, well, it was the first book of its kind from our region. But it's, you know, I always tell people, this one book cannot do everything. And women have their own stories and they should tell them. I told those stories of a couple of the women that were in my life that I knew, who would very easily tell me, of course, you and I can go out and I'll be dancing with my girlfriend in those, you know, most heterosexual vibey club, and no one would know. And that's part of patriarchy. It's like, you know, men, not all men, obviously, but a good number of men believe that women are there for their entertainment, unless a person is very clearly outwardly presenting in a butch fashion. And even then, they just think that she hasn't had them, and that if she has a man like them, she would be a good wife or good girlfriend or whatever it is. And so my queer women friends, as few as they are, would say to me, this is why we can go out and we can dance and we can do everything, because no one even, it never crosses anyone's mind that we're together. Since my book came out, though, there have been a rash of stories about queer women from West Africa. There's one woman who wrote a old memoir called Embracing My Shadow, Growing Up Lesbian in Nigeria. There has been an anthology called She Calls Me Woman, all about women's stories from Nigeria that are LGBTQI. In various iterations, you know, some of these are married women, some of these are women who are single. I mean, but these stories exist. And I think the great thing about having Lives of Great Men in print was that it spurred publishers to take a chance on some of these other stories. And my initial goal, in a way, has sort of been, is being realized, because no one who is objective can say that, you know, we don't have these in this country, because now we're having all these narratives from people, you know, men, women, older people, younger people. There's a comfort now in being able to tell some of these stories. Conservative people, liberal people, very churchy people, very Islamic people. I mean, these stories are there and they're finding avenues to be told. So that, I think, is a good thing. But no, my book does not delve in great detail about women, because I could only write about the women in my life. And I didn't do a deep dive on casting this wide net to talk to a whole bunch of lesbians, because I wasn't really telling their story. And now their stories are coming out. So.
Wow, that's great to know. So it does feel like things are changing. And thinking about change, Frankie, one of the benefits of looking back at a project like this, like the book, a few years down the line, is that you do get a sense of the changes happening around it, right? In the case of the book, you can get a sense of reception, impact, and so on. Lives of Great Men was obviously very well received abroad, internationally, but I'm also very curious to know, what was the reception like in Nigeria?
You know, the book has sold in Nigeria. It's done well in Nigeria. I think it could have done better if it had print editors who were bold enough to review it on its merit and not be afraid of its content. There was some print reviews that were online, but none of the major publications reviewed it. And that speaks to their fear of the content. So despite the lack of objectivity from the press, particularly print, the book has done well on radio. Many people have interviewed me on radio. The book I've had readings in Nigeria and people have showed up out of curiosity. I've done book signings in Nigeria. I still get people till today who have managed to be able to find this book. There are people who have heard about the book and who found my Nigerian publisher and found a way to get it. And I still get letters from people. And the thing that is the most touching, but also the most common, is people saying for the first time they see themselves in our literature. And they see themselves as complete people and not as caricatures. So overall, I will say that, of course, there are challenges. But overall, I think the book has gone beyond my expectation in Nigeria. It's done well. So yeah, I'm very proud of the way the ordinary Nigerians have embraced the book.
Beautiful. Well, I want to push the conversation further into the issue of change. From what you're saying, it seems like there is a growing interest in queer narratives and stories. Obviously, there is your book. You also mentioned a few new books that are coming out. And I wonder if that indicates a certain shift in terms of new channels or avenues for queer representation and storytelling.
Well, it indicates that people are saying, you know, our story is our story and we don't have to keep quiet about it. Because now we're seeing, I mean, even now I hear about people who are trying to publish stories from very conservative parts of Nigeria. You know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. We are not a minuscule minority. We're a full-fledged part and parcel of the society. Now, obviously, there's a commercial side to this where not every book is going to sell a lot of copies, but books will be there and they'll be available about our lives. And that is very important because that really is the recorded history for the future. No matter the obstacles that the traditional publishers put in their way, and because they will always tell you that these books don't sell and, you know, why do you want to do that and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I had a publisher in Nigeria who didn't think like that. And she thought this was an important book to do. You know, it was not a consideration for her how many people would buy it. This was an important book to do. So some of these considerations are, yes, commercial. But at the same time, I don't think that you have to be super commercially successful to make a change. So we have to believe that our stories are valid, not necessarily what the so-called gatekeepers who may have their own bias tell us. And when one door closes, you just keep going until you find the next one. And I'm so happy that people are telling their own stories now. Because for me, it's history. Whether one person buys it or 10 people buy it, it's out there.
That's so true. And you know, since we're speaking about getting things out there, would you like to conclude by, you know, leaving a word of advice or encouragement, perhaps, to young queer people in Africa or elsewhere who are struggling to find a voice, trying to get something out there? What would you say to them?
I would say that, you know, you have to just do it. And there's no time limit on it. Writing is not easy. It's hard. Producing a book that is a good quality book is hard. So my, you know, if I'm even qualified to give anybody advice on this kind of stuff, is I would say just do the work. Do the work and don't be discouraged, because if you do the work and it takes you longer, but you're proud of what you've done, the work will speak for itself and it will find the right place to be published. But, you know, it's hard work, but doesn't mean that it should be closed to us because people think that the stories that we want to tell are not commercially viable. No. All of our stories are valid, each and every single one of them. And we have to do the work to tell them properly and in a way that we can be proud of even years later after we finish them.
Great. Frankie, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a great chat.
Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure. And thank you everyone for listening to Talking Queer. If you liked this episode, please share on social media. To know more about the series, please check the website of the Gala Queer Archive or follow us on social media. This project has been sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, with funds from the Ministry of International Cooperation and Development of the Federal Republic of Germany. We also want to thank Jim Chuchu and the Ness Collective for allowing us to use in this podcast a musical track from the Stories of Our Lives film. To listen to the entire soundtrack, visit the collective SoundCloud.